Welcome to the EDUCAUSE podcast. This podcast features a session from the EDUCAUSE 2008 annual conference. You can find more podcasts like this by visiting www.educause.edu/podcasts or subscribe to our iTunes feed by searching for EDUCAUSE. This podcast is sponsored by Real Networks and features a session from the EDUCAUSE 2008 annual conference presented by John L. Baines, Assistant Director of Confidentiality, Integrity, and Availability at North Carolina State University, and Mardicia S. Bell, Director of Security and Compliance and OIT at North Carolina State University. The session is entitled Structuring Authentication Across the Campus Community.
My name is Bill Phillips. I'm with the University of Central Florida right here in beautiful, warm, sunny Orlando, Florida.
Some other time.
It's warm in August. It's actually beautiful outside, but it is a little chilly. I'm pleased to introduce the session today, Structuring Authentication Across the Campus Community. And we're joined by two, I don't want to say the word veterans because there is a somewhat of a connotation with the term veterans, but these two individuals have a combined 60 plus years of experience in this field. John Baines is the Assistant Director, Confidentiality, Integrity, and Availability from North Carolina State University, the Wolfpack, I believe.
That's correct.
Is that right? And Mardicia Bell is Director of Security and Compliance, also with North Carolina State University. Please don't forget to do your evaluations, your session evaluations. You can do them either at the kiosk out in the lobby, or you can do them online from the conference program page. Okay? They will field questions about 10 minutes before the session's over. They promised me they would take questions from all of you, and I'd like to turn it over to Mardicia. Nice to have you.
Thanks very much.
Thank you.
Thank you. I'd like to wish all of you a good afternoon. Today, what we're going to talk about is we're going to share with you the journey that NC State took to layer and strengthen our password and authentication structure. So the topics we're going to discuss I'm going to do the first three, talk about some compliance and some constraints that we have to deal with, talk about why we need to look at passwords, and then talk about some of the factors and issues that we had to deal with at NC State. Then I'm going to turn it over to John. He's going to talk about the solution that we put in place. He's going to talk about the expansion that we're going to do with what we have in place. And then we're going to share with you some lessons learned. So, to get started, we're going to talk about the gateway of constraints that we're faced with. This table right here is just a sample of some of the governance that we have to deal with. We have to deal with federal laws, state laws, contractual agreements, and this is just a sample. But as you can see, the data that we have to protect is wide, and it can be stored on a wide range of things, from a lab PC to a server to an enterprise database that we have. And this list is growing. We've just had something to come down from the Federal Trade Commission, the red flag rule, where now we have to have an identity theft prevention program that we have to put in place. So this list is growing. What does this mean for authentication? Well, now we have to look at the approach that we need to take, and we need to come up with ways so we can meet these requirements. We view the authentication as the key to our data. We also have to deal with hackers. We all are very familiar with the widely published incident that occurred at the Ohio University back in 2006, and this is a situation that none of us wants to be in, so we need to try to avoid that. The International Data Corporation has estimated that the market for the stolen identities has reached $1 billion. Okay. This is a table that was produced by Information Week back in 2007, and it shows how much we have to pay for this information that is compromised. And as you can see, the lowest price is PayPal account and login information. And so this goes to show that we have to pay attention to protecting the account and the passwords. So this leads into why we need to pay attention. When we pay attention, it does give us a major headache because there's lots of things we need to pay attention to. Authentication is the basis for providing access and the functionality that's associated with it. And the primary authentication key is the password. But we have a dichotomy. On one hand, we need for the passwords to be strong so they're not compromised. But then we also need for the user to easily remember them. So as a result, our data security heavily depends on the integrity of our password systems. And so we have a lot of worries that affect that integrity. We have shared accounts. Shared accounts means shared passwords. We have to be concerned with the change frequency. If that's less, then that does decrease the window for hackers. But the less the frequency, the harder that it is for the user to remember the password. So then they start rotating their passwords. And then we have to be concerned with the reset process. We have to make sure that we check the credentials, that the right person resetting that password is who's supposed to be doing that. We have to guard against the weak passwords, and when you have strong passwords, the users tend to forget them, so then they start writing them down. You can look under the keyboards or on the sides of the monitors and see that there. So our goal should be to strengthen the password controls. But then at the same time, we need to provide a way to transition to strengthen password controls. So we need to start looking at the strength of the authentication and base that on the individual's security role. We need to try to match that to the sensitivity of the data and the functional capabilities that are associated with that. But this is not a simple task to do. However, there are some technologies out there now, and they are becoming less expensive. However, to implement those with a campus the size of 40,000 people is still going to be a great cost. So we have to be able to justify that cost, and we need to make sure that it does not prohibit the user from doing their job. So we need to try to focus on the really sensitive data and try to do some pilots to determine that effect. So now I'm going to talk about some of the factors that we were faced with at NC State. So back in 1989 to 91, we were still in the mainframe then, but there was a growing concern about the unauthorized use of our data. So we embarked upon a project that we call the Challenge Response. It was a form of two-factor authentication. So what we put in place, we had a programmable calculator that we programmed. And when a user logged on to the mainframe screen, they typed in their user ID. They were presented with a random 10-character challenge number. They had to take that number, type it in to the calculator, and they pressed the enter button. They received a 10-character response number that was random. So then they took that number, went back to the login screen, and typed in that response. Then they were logged on. Needless to say, that was a bit kludgy. We did have the approval of the data stewards and some of the users at that time, but that quickly got old. That lasted for about 2.5 years, and then it was deemed that that was too stringent, and we did away with that process. So when we implemented the PeopleSoft human resources and financials software, that was our Y2K solution that went in place in 1999. We put the system in with a 90-day password interval. Then we had a state audit, and the auditors came back and said that 90 days was not enough. They wanted us to put the password interval down to 30 days for those privileged human resources and financial users. So when we did that, though, that was a manual process. So we had we did not capture some of the users that should have been at 30 days, and we probably put some users who didn't need to be at 30 days in the 30-day bucket. So then in late 2006, we did the self-service module. And so we were faced with users who had never logged on to the human resources system. They now had to change their password for the first time, a lot of them, because we were now using the portal as the front end to that. And we're now in the process, we're in a phased implementation with the student modules, and we now have more roles, more requirements that we have to deal with. And some of those things, So now we had a situation where we had the ERP systems with the 90-day, 30-day intervals, and they had these stringent requirements, but the portal was now going to be our gateway. And so the regular web login that the faculty and the students were used to, they were now having to use that to log in. So we had stringent and less stringent because the faculty and the staff who didn't use these systems, they were not used to changing their passwords. So we were faced with a situation. Some of the users said that they were not going to use the system because they had to change their passwords. And so we were in this situation that we had to deal with. So now I'm going to turn it over to John. He's going to tell you how we dealt with this situation, what we put in place.
Okay. Thanks, Mardisha. So I'm going to jump right in at the deep end here and then hopefully dig myself out. Start with the design and then the implementation and then some real lessons learned. When I looked at the University of Florida's GatorLink password management policy, and it was like a eureka moment. It has nothing whatsoever to do with the fact that our new CIO comes from the University of Florida. It did precede him, honestly. I wish I could claim credit for it myself, but we called them up, said, do they mind if we used it? Absolutely not. They said, you know, this is fine. We're pleased that you can make use out of it. We made very little changes in the overall design, although we extended it and actually implemented it in slightly different ways. First level they have five levels. The first level is entry. It covers things like guests, parents, student applicants, job applicants, people with a pretty loose affiliation with the university. They don't get access to any sensitive data. That satisfies a new requirement for the student system. The second level, and this is where we did make a change, University of Florida called it low security. I said, we can't have low security, so we changed it to standard. And that covers the majority of the campus, students, most faculty, some staff. They get access to sensitive information, but only about themselves. And we do know a good bit more about them when we know where they live. The third and the fourth really cover our administrative users. At the third level, it's departmental and college users. So they get sensitive data access at the unit or the departmental level. When you go up to the central office users, it needs to be more stringent. It is much more stringent on our approval process. They get sensitive data at the university level. Finally, rigorous. These are the ones that the 2002 auditors called accounts with godlike powers. And so they were rigorous. They used to control the institution-wide applications and database. The application administrators, the database administrators, and there weren't too many of them, but they were the ones that got the 30-day password. So this matrix lays out what we actually set up and what we changed by those individual levels, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5. You can see that under the maximum age of a password, that's how frequently is a user required to change the password, and we put it in at three levels. originally there was no requirement on the academic side to change password at all. We said, this is not good practice. You need to change it. But we'll let you do it once a year, 365 days. For the medium and high users, we already had the default of 90. And for the rigorous users, it was 30 days. Although if you look across at the number of users, you'll see that the rigorous users are listed here at 23. Originally, using the manual procedure that Mardisha talked about, there were 56 users. And they didn't include all this 23. So most of those 56 were very relieved that they went back to a 90-day password change. We also, on the administrative systems, are required to fill out a security agreement. We do that online now through the portal, and that applies to levels 3, 4, and 5 only. It doesn't apply to the people that don't have access to the administrative systems. We allow a phone reset of password in response to some user-supplied questions for all of the levels except rigorous, and rigorous has to present their credentials in person in order to get password reset. If you look at the numbers, it looks like I've rigged it. It really does, but I didn't. On the rigorous level, we've got 23. In the high, we've got 239. In the medium, 2,409. So it's like an order of magnitude each time. And then the vast majority of the campus users, almost 43,000 in standard. And the new entry level hasn't really taken off yet, but that's going to get really large, too, in terms of trying to track affiliations. So, if you're interested, I'm not going to spend a lot of time on this. We also use this as a technique to strengthen and standardize our password tests across all of the across all the different authentication systems. We've got about 9 different authentication systems. Basically, put this in place as a standard and said, for example, one of the strengthening things we did, originally we had a 7-digit requirement for phone numbers. Well, the internal phone numbers are 5 digits. So we said you can't have 5 consecutive numbers in a password. So that was one of the strengthening things. A user must change password immediately after a password reset, but the way that that's implemented at the moment is that it's reset to the default, and then there's a window of opportunity. The default does depend on some of the user's characteristics, but it's published in terms of how it's set, and then it stays at that until the user gets in there and changes it. So there's a window of opportunity for a hacker to get in there. Another thing that we said was where the location is remote to the help desk for those 23 rigorous users, and there was a number of them were over in another office building over the other side of campus, that we would allow them to present their credentials to somebody locally in that office. And that, they breathed a sigh of relief when we did that, believe me. They didn't want to trek. Well, it would have been too much to get them to trek across the help desk in person. So you got to, meter this with a bit of common sense and a bit of mercy. Okay, so let's talk about what we varied by password level. I've talked about the ones that we set up in the initial setup in that table, but these are the ones that we have that we can tweak and change. The minimum number length of password is currently set at 8. Before, some systems had been 6. We would like to set that higher. Maximum length of password, that dates back to Unix days in terms of 6 in some cases. We have not set a maximum. Maximum age of password we covered. Days of daily expiration warnings. For the rigorous users, since they're changing every month, we give them 7 days of warnings. For all of the other users, we give them 14 days saying, it's going to change. Do you want to change it now, or do you want to wait? And then on the 14th day, of course, they get told you've got to do it. Number of failed attempts before lockout. This was another strengthening factor as well. And all the levels are set at 8. Originally, that was 5 for the systems that did check it. There's been talk about increasing that number, too. Certainly, we had an absolute requirement that you should not reuse passwords. In the Florida Gatorlink implementation, they actually published the number of passwords that they remembered. I didn't think it was a good idea to do that because then people try and go through them to recycle. But we had a very large number, over 100, so I don't think they would have cycled through anyway. But just on the principle of the thing, we say you don't reuse passwords. Some of the parameters are binary, yes or no. And we've talked about most of these on that first chart in the current situation. Yeah, we talked about all those. For future use, the computer use policy document on a self-service reset or some kind of quiz or some kind of security awareness publication to get people to read that on a password reset. If we can do it in a proactive way where they really will learn something from it, it's worth something. If it's just a matter of, you know, spouse mode and click on the OK, then that's not such a good idea. So we've got to think a little bit creatively about that. We want to make the password reset self-service totally, and we will be getting into two-factor authentication again. It's a matter of when and how. And what we're doing here is setting up a structure where we can do it by account level. So, you know, for the, I got a pilot size with the rigorous, 23 people. I got a very cost-effective size for the most sensitive data in the central office users. And then I got a total population of the administrative users clearly defined in terms of 2,700 or so. So how did we do it? We really took a team approach to this with a team from across our Office of Information Technology. We took, in total, January 2007 through September 2007, so about 9 months in total. But we handled the students and the general staff and faculty much more quickly than that. We got that in a hurry in 3 months so that they weren't being asked to change their password every 90 days. We structured the password strength approach according to rules. We set these rules up with the assistance of the business analysts in the development team in the Office of Information Technology. They really understood the reasons that the PeopleSoft roles were there, and they really understood the business aspects of the applications. We verified them with the data stewards, but basically it was with help. We tried some things ourselves that just didn't work out to start off with. And then, why don't we ask the people that really know? So we went to the business analysts. We phased in the administrative users in a controlled way. That was much, they already had most of those parameters as standard anyway, but it was a matter of getting them across multiple systems and so forth. Does apply to all the users of the university systems. And I think the secret to our successful implementation was to clearly define the rules in a table that related to the PeopleSoft security roles so that we could automate this process. So let's talk about automating the process. Development team on the PeopleSoft roles created role templates that had a very strong naming convention. So we were able to define relatively few templates, which said if they start with this, or if they're this number of characters long, if they end with that, this is what you do. This is the account level that you put them into. And then using that table, we related each template role to the sensitivity of the column view of data that the user had from that role, the row view of data, and the functionality provided, whether they could just read or whether they could write or whether they could erase. We created a nightly batch process in order to analyze those PeopleSoft roles and do the implementation. We placed the individual accounts into an appropriate directory container. We used Novell EDIR, which was the one that we've been using for the administrative systems, and had one container for each of the 1 through 5. We add new PeopleSoft role templates to the table when we need to now. Yes, and when they don't do that, the default is level 3. So if it comes up against a role in PeopleSoft it doesn't recognize, it says put that in the level 3 bucket. As a result, if the development people forget to put it in the table, all of a sudden thousands of people get asked to change their passwords the next day because they've just gone to 90 days. Not a good idea. It's happened about 3 times since we went live. But after the first time, we did a kick out so that if we got more than a couple of hundred changes, we said, don't do it, just hold off, issue a warning message, and let the security and compliance team look into it. And then all of our authentication systems had to use the account directory container to determine the password level rules to apply. And we got plans for the future. First one I've already kind of hinted at in terms of that default password. We'd really like to control better when and how accounts are provisioned and how they're how passwords are communicated and changed. Want to automate those reset questions. So we don't have to involve help desk, time savings, and more convenience for the user. Want to use two-factor authentication. As I say, I've got a group now for a pilot, a group for a full implementation, and a group that should cover most of our sensitive data needs. One thing we've been requested is to increase the password length, but to also increase the password expiry time. When I look at the entropy of passwords, that's a pretty good deal. It actually strengthens the password quite a lot. So we might let certainly the level 3 go out to 365, but have a length of 12. And increase the number of password retries still further. And as I say, we've gone from 5 to 8. We'd like to go up to 12. And that way, we still want to lock out after a reasonable number of retries so we don't get brute force attempts. But at the same time, we do want to make it easier on the user and not push them into a reset situation. Certainly as we get more and more stringent requirements on the passwords themselves. Can tie a level of assurance to these account types. Quite effectively, I think. I'll talk about that under Federation in a minute. Prepare for Federation. So I've got a couple of slides now on Federation and where we're going with that. Okay, federated identity is really a user's identity is said to be federated between a set of providers when there is an agreement between the providers on a set of identifiers and or attributes used to refer to the user. Okay, that's a big mouthful. Let's look at it more practically. On the one hand, we have service providers. Service provider owns and knows the identity. They authenticate locally. So they say, all right, I'm North Carolina State. I've got my population. I can authenticate them. I'm, University of Central Florida. I know my population. I can authenticate them. Then you have service providers, and they may be within the same university. They may be Microsoft. They may be the federal government. They may be your local state university system. They don't know the identities, but they can authorize based upon what type of person it is coming in. So, for example, they might allow students to get one thing and faculty to get something different. Really, it's all based on trust. The identity provider trusts the service, and the service provider trusts the identity of the users that are in the identity provider. The big advantage to the identity provider is that the authentication parameters and the details of the individuals, particularly password, never leave the identity provider. With an LDAP implementation, for example, that's going out to whoever's using LDAP to do the authentication on their system. That's not good. We only pass classification parameters to the service provider. But the service provider, on the other hand, also gets benefits. He doesn't have to maintain a directory of all the users that he's supporting. And he can base authorization on the parameters passed over by the identity provider. So, on the one hand, we need authentication standards, and that's what we've been building our account levels for. And on the other hand, we can map those to external standards, for example, levels of assurance, and the entry level. On that one, all we really know about them is we've got a verified email address. So they get level zero. Level of assurance. On the other hand, with the central office user, they have, they've been seen in person, they presented a passport or a driver's license or some sort of federal ID, they've been approved by the dean of the college or the department head, they've been approved by the data steward. So we know a lot about them, and that should basically give us a level two of assurance. That sounds fairly simple when you explain it like that, I hope. But when you think about it, it's really pretty clever. And there's a couple of implementations I'd like to talk about. One is a single sign-on. University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill is doing this, and we're seriously considering it at NC State also. What they have is, within the university network, one identity provider which does all of the authentication. And then the individual applications are defined as service providers so that they all use that single strong authentication. They don't have to worry about other than, what account level is it or what type of user is it in terms of the parameters being passed. When we turn it around and we say we've got one service provider and multiple identity providers, we get the more typical implementation, but for example, in the University of North Carolina General Administration, we're using this now. We've got both of these live in different areas in North Carolina. The first application that was implemented here was a catalog of distance learning courses across all of the institutions in the North Carolina system. And a student could go in, pick any particular one, register on it. He authenticated at his local institution, so GA didn't have to keep a list of everybody. And then the credits came back to his local institution as well. So kind of a nice thing. The bigger thing there might be software as a service. In Common Federation certainly does that sort of thing. It's the most widely used, the most generally accepted of federations, certainly in the higher education environment. It's been very, very successful. It's developed by Internet 2, and it is national in the United States at a trans-university level. They've currently, as I looked at the list on the website this week, 73 university identity providers and 36 commercial and government service providers. Now, in common is just the trust fabric between those two that link them. And there's a lot of checking in there in terms of, is this really this identity provider? Is this really this service provider? Let's make sure that they that they have good technological basis for trusting each other so that we don't get hacked on it. Because that's pretty serious. It's standard-based shibboleth. It includes, for example, Microsoft DreamSpark. Microsoft DreamSpark is software available for students to download. Originally, you had to register with Microsoft as a student to get it. Now, Microsoft is trusting in Common. If a Common says you're a student, you can automatically, on the spot, download Visual Studio Pro, Expression Studio, Windows Server Standard Edition, and SQL Server Developer edition. This really represents a lot of value to institutions and students for coursework and for other university projects. Okay. So we'd like to focus very quickly on some lessons learned in the last few minutes. We knew we had a problem in terms of users not liking having their passwords changed. So we said, how do we turn this around and make it a user awareness program? We responded to all the objectors and all the people with questions. But we picked an influential group of 50 faculty and executive objectors to password expiration time that said, I shouldn't be having to change it every 90 days. And we took two approaches. Either we said, here's the sensitive data you're accessing, here are the PeopleSoft roles you're using, you really need, this is sensitive stuff. And they either agreed with us on that, and they said, no, I don't need that stuff, I've delegated all of that. So we used principle of least privilege, pulled those roles from them. So we really did a cleanup in terms of the people that could access the more sensitive data. And everybody was happy. Very positive action from the users either way. Enhancing security awareness at the highest levels in the university. As I say, the dean was the one that was saying, if I have to change my password, I'm not using this stupid system. So what we did was give them an easy button. So, in conclusion, very quickly. First of all, when you're strengthening security provisions, don't look at the level of the person. It doesn't matter particularly whether they're a dean or whether they're an administrative assistant. It's what data do they have access to. And you need to create multiple levels that make sense to you. The levels created at the level at the University of Florida made sense to us. And will need to be others in terms of, it's clear when you're using Federation that you need to define a student as a student. But there are things like that as well. We need to be able to address our long-term authentication improvements, and we've put ourselves in a position for two-factor authentication again. We're preparing for federation with other institutions. We've got it live on a couple of starter bases by standardizing our local authentication. And we address our security awareness with passwords. And if you do this right, you can use these to actually improve security awareness rather than to get people mad. Are there any questions? Yes. We haven't really decided yet. We're looking at a number of things. Secure USB tokens. RFIDs show some promise. That's a very inexpensive way. Certainly biometrics, although they're very nice, I love the little fingerprint reader on my laptop. Campus in general, the faculty has, rightly or wrongly, has secure privacy concerns about them. So I think we'll be sticking to something physical. Good question. Another question? We've been trying to give them ways of developing strong passwords from using a phrase and using the first characters of words and substituting numbers, substituting special characters like at or parentheses or whatever. That seems to be working quite well. Yes? Well, you're saying in terms of making it a phrase or in terms of our rules that I put up here? Well, you're absolutely right from the point of view of passwords are reaching the limit of what of the strength that they can provide. We've got to go to something stronger. So that's what we're preparing for. Other questions? There was somebody back there. Yes?
Does your lockout procedure require them to come in and have their account re-enabled, or does it go back into available after a certain time period?
No, it does require them to go in and have it re-enabled as it stands today. The lockout The lockout is just for a period of time, I believe. Do you know, Mardisha? I'd have to check into that.
Of attempts.
Only for the rigorous level, that one. For the other ones, they call up the help desk and they have to answer a question like, you know, what's the name of your first cat? Or whatever. They choose the questions and put them in the system, the user does. And then the help desk asks them, and if they can answer the questions right, the help desk resets the password at that point. That's our current approach. Somebody at the back has had their hand up for a while. Yes. We're in the process of putting that in place. Yes. We've got a data classification statement in our data management procedures. It defines three levels. One is very secure. We call it red. Two is moderate, yellow. And three is requires an audit trail, but no more than that, green. We've been fighting with what do we put where, and I went to a seminar on the first day here, and two of the things they told us were things that we'd already come to the conclusion of, and actually used the same terms. The first one was to define a red, not just the red data, but a red hot list of data, the ones that are really critical, and then work on those. The second thing was that if I count FERPA as red data, and say for red data, for example, I've got to encrypt all the hard drives, then FERPA data is everywhere. And I'm going to have to apply my strictest standards to all of my systems. So basically, we're coming to the conclusion we have to move FERPA into the yellow category, or maybe even create a separate category for it. So yes, we're in process of implementing it. Yes, it will probably be tied into the account level process. At this point, it's not. We're working on it. Watch this space next year. Any other questions? Yes. Right. Well, I've got the rigorous users, who are the DBAs and the application administrators. I've got 23 of them. That's where I start with my pilot. Okay, I've got the users that are accessing university-wide data at very sensitive levels. I've got 239 of those. That's not a lot to pay for. Now, admittedly, I've got to put software and procedures and potentially some other equipment in place, but that's... I can still limit the population that applies to. It's a lot less than 43,000. Yes? Not yet. Again, it's a desire. And they'd be in the entry-level category. And again, we've got to define how we're going to show those affiliations in the system. We're working on that one, too. Well, it's a big identity management problem universities have from the point of view of keeping up with the person and identifying them when they're coming back as the same student or the same employee or the same whatever, and keeping all of those different types of relationships that they've had over their life under one user ID, which is important. Any more? Yes?
Another question?
Right. Not really. Right now, what we're doing is I could do another presentation immediately after this one if you like, but I won't. But we've been implementing Sun's Identity Manager, and we've been doing it for fine-grained authorization on the back end. And as part of that, we are provisioning using SAML, both into PeopleSoft and from PeopleSoft back into our front-end directory in the Identity Manager. And SAML seems to be the way to go for that.
As a follow-up, how hard would you rate the integration between Sun and PeopleSoft?
We chose Sun Identity Manager because they had adapter technology. The original one that comes with Sun is not very sophisticated. As part of our proof of concept, we insisted that they develop us one that would work with multiple levels of people tools and multiple levels of people soft and provision directly into the back end using the proper interfaces. And sure enough, they got that working in about 3 or 4 weeks. And we've got that live now. Sun has the IP rights for that. I'm trying to encourage them to issue that as the adapter for the Identity Manager that's the official PeopleSoft one. Because yeah, me too. But if you can put any pressure on Sun, that would be great. NC State. Thank you all for your time.
Thank you so much.
We've enjoyed it. If you have any more questions, come see us afterwards.
This EDUCAUSE 2008 Annual Conference podcast is sponsored by Real Networks. Real Networks enables digital delivery of distance learning coursework, athletic events, and more to students anywhere. Information at realnetworks.com.